Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
Hey John, how are you?
Surviving so far, huh?
That's the bar nowadays.
Yeah, a lot of changes lately. I think a bit of a learning process for the big banks. I just saw JP Morgan is opening a digital bank in the UK.
You mentioned this. So this is another bank in the UK. It seems like every big bank is launching a bank and then sort of folding it and then relaunching it now. What is going on with JP Morgan's new bank offering? It's crazy.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned the learning process, because they fold it, they're trying again, that didn't work. JP Morgan Chase had their Finn product, which was their little digital experiment to take on Chimes and the Revoluts and the Starlings of the world. But I guess these are kind of half-hearted attempts, it feels like. They don't have the full force, although they might say otherwise. They lost for some few million dollars on it. I think they're starting to come around and decide that they're in this case, JP Morgan's going to use their own name, so it's going to be branded under Chase, and they want to kind of build up. And I think the example of Marcus has been informative too. They've been doing better than the other large banks in their fintech digital bank offering. But it's interesting that they're doing it in the UK first, as well.
And it's interesting because Marcus was essentially a greenfield play for Goldman Sachs, right? Goldman Sachs didn't have a retail product, they didn't have a personal lending product, and that's the ground that Marcus covers. It seems like with Chase launching a quote unquote digital bank, I don't understand how they could differentiate a product from their mainline Chase mobile app, which is pretty great actually. So how is this different?
Well, first, they don't have any retail presence in the UK, which I was surprised to read, actually. I thought, oh, JP Morgan, the huge, huge bank, and not much of a retail presence. I'm sure they do have all their commercial and business services, but not so much. So it will be starting from scratch for them. But they're going up against some stiff competition. As I mentioned, we have Monzo, Starling. I mean, the UK and London in particular are just loaded with these very competitive online banks. And actually, our guest today, Charlie Dellingpole, the founder of Comply Advantage, used to work for JP Morgan and is actually in the UK right now. How are you doing, Charlie?
It's great to be here, Steve and John.
Yeah, so what do you think of fintech space and Chase jumping in into the market there?
So I know most of the neobanks in the UK pretty well, and lots of them are clients. Specifically, I think the launch of Chase in the UK is about net interest income margin and harvesting deposits, given they have FDIC imposed limits on their market share in the US. They also announced today that they're investing something like $800 million in a property lending platform called LendInvest. It's fairly easy to see that to fund those liabilities, it will need assets in terms of deposits. So basically, if it can harvest deposits at sub 1% and then lend them out on LendInvest at 10%, then there's 9% margin to be had. So I don't think it's going to be about harvesting clients like Monzo have and not being able to make real material net interest income. I think fundamentally, JP Morgan has a huge business in the UK in terms of investment banking, in terms of corporate lending. So they have a great platform for generating net interest income. And in terms of matching US, in terms of being able to match sterling denominated assets and liabilities together and remove any FX risk and make margin there, that makes compelling sense. So there's a very obvious need for this. And it's not like RBS that have kind of launched and failed various initiatives in the UK to do with problems in their core banking application. It's more they want to be able to harvest quickly lots of deposits.
Do you think they'll be able to do it?
I think super easy to be honest. I think I'm a client of one of our clients called Oak North, and they're funding property loans, and they have money from SoftBank, and all you need is to offer a high interest rate, and immediately you're number one in the interest rate tables. You've seen the withdrawal of most of the market's high interest rate loans, but they've already got what they need in terms of deposits. So I think anyone offering a decent interest rate can harvest billions very, very quickly.
Oh, that's great information. We're going to have you on every week.
It'd be my pleasure.
Okay, great, great. Well, you're the founder of Comply Advantage, which is a reg tech in the perfect market for this. Like you said, you have a lot of clients right there in the UK. Well, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and Comply Advantage?
So this is the third company that I've started. The second one was quite relevant in that that was a fintech company as well. So we were taking money, marketplace lending from high net worths and hedge funds and lending companies and lending it out to SMEs. So I built that platform. And then in 2014, I guess I saw the kind of wave of fintech startups coming. And also saw the problems, as in I felt the pain personally of dealing with money laundering, terrorist financing in my role at Market Invoice. And so I thought there was a huge opportunity to revolutionize how companies dealt with the risk of terrorist financing, money laundering, and sanctions. And we've now raised $100 million. We have 260 people. We have clients in 80 countries. We have 30 in New York and the rest of the US. Teams in Singapore, Romania. So, we think we're going to try and solve the problem of money laundering and terrorist financing.
That's quite a lofty goal there. So I actually went through the report that you recently published, maybe a week ago or so, and there's some really interesting points here that are kind of scary, but also kind of interesting. One thing that I noticed in there, just sort of as a top line number, is that 73% of your respondents say they have filed more SARs after COVID than before. Why do you think that is?
I think what you've seen with the Paycheck Protection Program and the kind of industrial quantities of money transfer. So US debt has gone up from something like 100% GDP to like 120% now, I think is the correct number. And I think you've seen fraud rates, which are now 40 times higher in neobanks and fintech companies than in traditional banks like community banks. And that's because lots of them are kind of new clients. You're seeing kind of waves of fraud, both in terms of criminal groups stealing money from government programs. And you're seeing also, given now everyone's online and at home, you're seeing people trying to impersonate other groups, like steal, to kind of pose as the IRS or sell fake PPE goods like masks. And what that means is that these banks and payment companies have to detect and then prevent that money from being siphoned through their accounts, which leads to SARs. So principally it's because there's a avalanche and explosion of fraud and money laundering.
There's also another piece in the report that's really fascinating, which mentions the fact that nowadays fraud, as you say, is a bigger priority for banks than politically exposed persons. I saw in the news recently there's a really interesting story about the wife of an Azeri banker. I'm sure you know what it is. There's been this renewed effort to enforce what's called the unexplained wealth order in the UK. Can you talk us through what that is, how that's being used, and how the work that you're doing can address that kind of work as well?
Yeah, so there was a person called Zemira Hajieva who bought a property in 2009 for £11.5 million. Her husband was the chairman of International Bank of Azerbaijan, who was sentenced to 15 years for imprisonment for fraud and embezzlement. And so I think what globally entities like the Financial Action Task Force, you saw this a lot with Steven Mnuchin, who was Secretary of Treasury under Trump, is there's multilateral action to try and prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, to try and prevent terrorist financing, and also corruption and bribery. And so the exfiltration of funds from the state in Azerbaijan to properties in London is a big issue. And previously, there was no mechanism to take the proceeds of crime or corruption because there was a presumption of innocence until guilt was proven. The UWO, Unexplained Wealth Order, shifts that to kind of no smoke without fire and presumes that if you can't explain clearly the source of the wealth, then you have to have those assets taken from you. And so that's a really important new tool to be able to counteract the wave of dirty money that's descending upon and washing over many capitals like New York or London or Singapore all over the world.
It's worth noting also that this woman who has been charged with this new order, her husband's official salary was maybe $70,000 or something in that range, and she ended up buying all these properties in Knightsbridge and I think even a golf course and a Gulfstream jet as well. So there's definitely a disconnect between her official source of funds and what she's done. What do you think makes these cities so attractive to people who want to launder their money? In terms of London, as you mentioned, Singapore, New York as well. Why those cities and not other centers? Is it just the infrastructure that's in there, or is there something else intrinsic about them that makes them more attractive?
I think one key thing is, particularly for Zemira, our friend, was that I think she spent £16.3 million on gift wrap purchases. She spent £5,000 on underwear and socks. She spent £1 million in the toy department. So she went on a huge spending spree. So first off, rich global people want nice, cool shops. They want like nightclubs. They want like lifestyle, right? So, Frankfurt is a nice place, but it's a town of 300,000 people, right? So I think bankers and rich people want nice restaurants and nice things, and those things are available in New York. The secondary reason is that when you have massive financial flows, it's very easy to hide the money within that. When you go to a small place, then there's very little like any kind of money will have a big impact and be noticed. Whereas in London, when you've got trillions of dollars flying around every single day, it's very easy to disguise the needle in the haystack, as long as there is a haystack.
Have you come across anything similar in any of the clients that you can share now that have used your technology to identify people like her?
Every day, the whole time, clients have that. So we have kind of 700 or so clients in the country. Some of them are screening like 10, 20 million names and monitoring those client bases. So they're constantly finding entities that are sanctioned, politically exposed, politically adverse media. And it's a kind of arms race because people who say are high risk want to hide that they are high risk, so they can get their relatives to apply for their accounts. They can disguise what they're doing. So if you're applying for a small business loan, you could say, "Hey, we're running a media company," whereas actually you're trafficking humans and prostitutes from say Eastern Europe or South America to brothels. And there's no way that bank will know that you're not a media company and in fact you are trafficking humans. So you asked the question, do clients find this? Like, absolutely. And every industry, every geography is a threat, as in it could be Robin Hood that's targeted, as in you put money in, you buy lots of options, suddenly you've got loads of cash that you can then exfiltrate. And that's a core layering mechanism in money laundering, as in you can say money didn't come from human trafficking, it came from out of the money options on small gaming companies.
You mentioned kind of this core layering of the money and the money laundering process. Have you seen anything new in this area? Like people are using well, you mentioned Robinhood, I guess just a new player because they're big. Or have there been like kind of new technology that's being used or developments that you see?
The whole time. So with every new form of finance or new technology, there's always a way to launder money. And that could be I think what you've seen with massively multiplayer online role-playing games, things like treasure chests in kind of World of Warcraft are kind of used as mechanisms of moving money around. So whereas you think you're actually buying or paying for a kind of virtual sword, that money can then be taken by the recipient and then used to launder money. So that's one example. But with every new kind of fintech, it opens up all kinds of risks, all kinds of threats, and therefore you have to use some sort of technology to deal with a massive problem which has emerged.
Yeah, we've seen this, and we've commented before on the, you have to grudgingly admire this creativity, this all this brain power going into doing these awful, awful things and hiding the illicit gains from it. Well, one thing I've been looking at very closely are the new changes in the U.S. administration, the appointments coming in, new rules, from a wide range. It seems like a very total government turnaround, 180 degrees in some cases, like on climate change. What are your initial impressions, and is there anything that stands out for you?
I think the most interesting area is going to be in the OCC. So that's a kind of independent division of the Treasury, because you had Brian Brooks, who was the ex-chief legal officer of Coinbase. And I think he had a very pro-crypto policy. There was some sort of adversarial tension between him and Steven Mnuchin, who was very anti-crypto, I think. And Janet Yellen seems to be anti-crypto to the extent that during her confirmation, she was talking about how she felt that there was lots of issues with the way in which crypto had been used for terrorist financing. She said the technology has accomplished this change over time. We need to make sure our methods for dealing with these matters with terrorist financing change along with technology. So Janet Yellen is saying that we need to have a step change in the way that we deal with terrorist financing over crypto. The candidate to replace Brian Brooks is former Ripple advisor Michael Barr, and he is an ex-advisor to Ripple, which is like Coinbase, a crypto company, but unlike Coinbase, under suspicion of massive fraud with the XRP token. So
Right.
I think we don't know precisely what his attitude will be. I think we do know that to get any kind of serious position in the government dealing with banking regulation, you need to have some sort of crypto experience, given how central it will be to finance going forward.
There's a few people who have been sort of surfaced as potential members of the regulatory regime who actually have strong background in both Bitcoin and crypto and also in DLT as well. Which is interesting because I think that this will mark, as you mentioned, a shift towards maybe a more pro crypto framework. And I'm wondering if you could sort of wave your magic wand and change the way in which both the US and the UK deal with cryptocurrencies now, what would you change about it?
So, what you saw under the previous OCC chairman was a series of regulations which all promoted the adoption of crypto amongst the largest banks. So, there was statements that in terms of IVNNs, so kind of blockchains being able to be used for settlement and treasury, he's saying in September he said that banks can hold stablecoin related assets for customers. So kind of a core part of the treasury could be stablecoins. And then only a few weeks ago before he left, he said that banks can also use the IVNN networks, as in blockchains and stablecoins, as a payment mechanism. So that kind of fundamentally undermines Fedwire, other treasury mechanisms. And then previously in July, he said that banks can use cryptocurrency assets for safekeeping. So in terms of hollowing out the Fed and making crypto the core mechanism for the store of value and the means of exchange, that was his attempt. So all the kind of changes that were wanted were promoted by Brian Brooks. I think the Treasury under Mnuchin, separate to the OCC, was trying to get rid of unhosted wallets, and you've seen the extension of that consultation for another 3 months, I think, yesterday. So that's a key battleground. So are they going to allow unhosted wallets? And I think Mnuchin said with regard to unhosted wallets, he said that he didn't want crypto to become the equivalent of secret numbered accounts. So that's a key battleground, is are you going to allow unhosted wallets? And if so, how do you then make crypto clean and not infect the rest of the system globally?
Yeah, that seems like a pretty baseline good policy, right? So kind of shifting back to the Comply Advantage space here. So you guys have been in business for a couple of years now. You've raised, as you mentioned, over $100 million or so. How have you seen technologies for AML shift as well? And I'll give you some color here. I used to work at JP Morgan, and I worked in a massive KYC project maybe 7 years ago or so, maybe just before that. But essentially, I could see how there was a difference in the way in which technology was deployed for the quote-unquote boring stuff of KYC AML versus how it was deployed for more, let's say, more revenue-generating things like trading or even personalizing offerings. So there seemed to be a disconnect between how money was spent for KYC versus for other purposes. So how have you seen technology rise to the challenge of addressing the volume and the scope and the types of KYC fraud cases versus other things from a Comply Advantage perspective?
So what we're doing is kind of really focused around some core processes. So the key thing for any bank or payment company is when you're onboarding clients, you need to know if that person is bad or not. So sanctions, terrorist financing, money laundering, political exposure. So, and then once they're on board, you need to know if they become bad. And then once they start transacting, you need to know if their behavioral patterns, which mean that they could be diverging from the pattern of behavior they said they would be when they onboarded. And that's the area that we focused on. And in terms of how AI and machine learning is used, our key asset is this kind of risk information graph of every person and company in the world and every risk about them. And whereas analysts were previously used to generate the data, we're doing it automatically. So we're looking at 10 billion web pages. We're looking at 50,000 unstructured and structured sources. And we're combining that to try and get towards a single graph of every person and company in the world. I think when I was running my second company, it's fairly clear that no company really wants to focus on AML unless they have to, as in compliance always comes last, because, you know, at least for me, you're under existential threat of destruction, as in you have to pay for everything, you have to grow, that's the real focus. But in the back of your mind, it's like, I could go to jail, something goes wrong. So that's why I started the company, is because it was an opportunity to solve a really important problem. And there's no way that you get that opportunity as part of the rest of the company, because it's like, as you say, it's never really the core kind of focus of the company.
Yeah, I like the way on your website and in this State of Financial Crime 2021 report, you make it very simple, very clear cut what the issue is. And I like that the report has what does this mean for my business kind of section, which, you know, breaks it down, you know, very, very simply. And I think that's something that everybody that's dealing with something complicated, I feel like it's their role to make it understandable. And on the website, you have a compliance doesn't have to be painful. Or, you know, in big letters right at the very beginning. I think that's, obviously that's you've done well with that approach. That's the right approach to take and kind of breaking down what this is. Now, we've talked to RegTech people before who kind of advocate or try to instill in their clients in the financial industry that compliance, detecting fraud, these things can be key business advantages, not just, as you say, this initial or traditional thinking that this is a back office cost and not a value to the company. But do you see with the newer fintechs or even with older companies that they're starting to get this lesson, that problems that Robinhood has had, that other companies have had, has sunk in? Or is it the same kind of thing where you have to start from scratch and explain how you're really a value add to their financial organization?
Exactly. It's a great question, Jordan. And that's kind of partly why, you know, in terms of compliance being advantage, that's kind of why I kind of called the company Comply Advantage, I guess. So I kind of felt that.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that was a kind of, for me, like compliance being an advantage was why I started the company rather than being, you know, so I'll start with like three reasons why that's the case. Firstly, it's existential. So the first client we had was trying to move money to Somalia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and you have groups like ISIS, Taliban, Al-Shabaab, kind of.
Oh, you were born in fire with this company.
Yeah. So, opposite the Saudi embassy in London, like guns everywhere, trucks full of cash coming in every day, and money being shipped via like Dubai to the like Horn of Africa, right? And problems with like groups of Christians in like Kenya on the border of Somalia being taken off the bus if they can't recite the first verse of the Quran, they're kind of killed immediately. That's there's kind of, on the one hand, you want to feed your family in Somalia, but you can't because the money's being de-risked, right? And also problems with, say, there's no like identism in Somalia, and you have to rely on like a tribal elder with a thumbprint, right? So, and therefore the banks were saying, listen, upside is like £1 million a year, downside is $1 billion fine, therefore I'm closing all your accounts, therefore for Dahabshiil, you no longer exist, right? So if your business is shut down and you can't get access to money, then you cease to exist, right? So the competitive advantage of compliance there is existing, right? And that's true with, say, crypto companies, because if you can't get money, if you can't deposit money into a crypto account, then you can't buy the Bitcoin, and therefore you don't exist, right? So there's the existential angle. Secondly, there's the cost angle in terms of, there are some, like there's one fintech in London that has 600 people in the compliance team, right? So that's very expensive. And then thirdly, there's the kind of frictional costs in terms of, you want to apply, it takes you like a month to sign up and then you'll shut down, right? So, and there's legislation around tipping off. So you aren't allowed to tell a money launderer that you're turning them off because they suspect they're a money launderer, because that's alerting to the case and they might kind of hide. So you need to not do that, and that kind of leads to like Kafka-esque results with normal clients. So in terms of existential existence, in terms of massive costs, and in terms of friction and consumer experience, compliance needs to be a competitive advantage.
Fintechs typically prioritize, product, technology, maybe some sales, UX, UI, but there's not a lot of emphasis placed on compliance. So, how can Compliance Advantage offer sort of an out of the box suite of solutions for new fintechs to tackle all these issues, so they can focus on the product and the experiences and on making just something that customers will want?
Exactly. So we're covering the two core processes they need to have. So can I onboard this client? And then once they're onboarded, do they become bad? And what's their transactional behavior? So that's the core of any compliance program. And we can get clients live immediately with all those systems. They can integrate out of the API box like immediately, very low cost, and they have the benefit of something that we've spent hundreds of millions of developing for kind of a very low cost, and it can scale with them effortlessly. So in effect, they kind of outsourced the critical parts of their compliance process to Comply Advantage.
So you necessarily use a lot of machine learning in this. Another magic wand question, I guess. So what is the next development in AI and NLP and in machine learning that you would want to see that would help your business?
For us, what we're doing is taking every person, every company in the world, and all data in the world, and building profiles of risk, and then allowing companies to decide if they want this person or company to be onboarded. So I think we invest very heavily in the data identification, like finding new sources, like finding, to our friend earlier, the Azerbaijan Central Bank, that would be a source. We monitor that and decide to include that as a high risk place. So we then want to constantly ingest and enrich. And so with our risk information graph, we're constantly broadening, deepening, expanding in terms of breadth and time that data, more connections, more relatives, more known associates, more languages, data in like Dutch, Chinese, improving the efficiency and effectiveness of the algorithm. So such that, if you've got 20 million clients, you don't get every day 100,000 alerts. So in terms of what we want to improve, I think there's lots of very cool stuff coming out. So we're constantly looking at scientific papers for algorithms we can improve the effectiveness of the algorithms, in terms of entity extraction, accuracy, recall, some very cool stuff coming out from OpenAI. I think if we could automatically build a profile given like terabytes of data, then that's the kind of plan, and see everything, the kind of Bentham Panopticon style strategy. So I think OpenAI allow you to generate an image or a kind of description simply from one line of normal text, right? I think that's going to be applied to what we're doing. So I think although we've invested millions in the current infrastructure, I think that will radically change going forward as new forms of machine learning are released.
A follow up on that. I know that the OpenAI thing, for example, I heard that actually on a podcast last night that if you tell the OpenAI algorithm, show me a picture of a couch shaped like an avocado, it'll give you that just based on inference and all that stuff. How would that be useful for the AML KYC space?
There's also the text version of that, right? So I guess you kind of build an oracle, right? So it says like, what are the risks associated with Steve Perez from New York, right? And it would tell you everything about Steve Perez, right? And like right now we spend a ton of money and time building profiles, right? And so I think any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I think, if we could generate like what we're building via a generalizable algorithm, then that would be quite powerful, right?
Yeah, it sounds like kind of what you're describing from the Panopticon kind of perspective is kind of what China is building. Would they have the perfect compliance system for every aspect of life as far as you see it?
They have the Chinese social credit system linked to Alipay. And they also have a network of on-the-ground informants in the villages, which can feed into that. So, and they are also linked into like the train system, right? So, if you want to get a high-speed train from like Shanghai to Chengdu, and you have defaulted on a loan, then that will be banned, and therefore you'll have to like take a bus, right? So, our intuition is that risk is linked, as in a credit default might be because it's actually a fraudulent loan, or you've missed the identity of that person incorrectly, or they were laundering. So, I mean, the point is that I think we want to build something that's useful for all kinds of risk. The dystopian 1984 Big Brother aspects of Chinese social credit and social control obviously are not ones we want to replicate. For us, we want to reduce terrorist financing, money laundering. We're not trying to like build a hellscape of social control that you've seen Chinese social credit become.
For sure. No, and we're not accusing you. Don't worry. So on the Russian side, we've seen break-ins and very sophisticated. I think the most sophisticated state actor is Russia, as far as I know. Is there any way to prevent these things? It seems like they have these very complex ways to break in, and even large organizations. Sophisticated players, government players, they all get hacked into. Is there really a way to prevent it? It just keeps happening.
Russia is a country with 120 million people. It's got an economy like which is probably like the size of a couple of Poland's, right? So it's kind of actually a very small country, and with the decline of oil as a natural resource, I think the kind of stance Russia has adopted towards the West and the adversarial intent. And the relationship with China has meant that I think it's become the kind of bogeyman. I don't think that the threat really is that great. The kind of bigger threats are more internal, I think, for the West in terms of our own attitude to each other. So I think in terms of hacking and in terms of ability to cause disruption, I think you've seen North Korea, you've seen other areas cause huge amounts of problems. I think it's always going to be the case that small groups of highly determined individuals can have an outsized impact. And given the the huge expanse of potential attack vectors. And I think it's challenging given the amount of money that's gone into security that and the amount of companies that do exist. I think that's a kind of generational challenge that won't go away anytime soon.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we're glad you're on the podcast this week. It's very informative. That's Charlie Dellingpole, the founder of Comply Advantage. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Great to meet you, Steve and John.
All right. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening.